Amatnam stepped forward, extending his palm. The sigil of binding was still etched there, and the demon twisted away, hissing.
"Jerk their leashes, Lacamhew, or I'll do it for you," Amatnam said. "Now!"
Lacamhew carved a sigil on the air with his crozius, and the blood letters turned their ugly gazes on the dark apostle. He spoke to them in their own tongue, and Amatnam winced at the sound. 8 of the creatures crouched on their haunches like attentive hounds. The others scattered, loping down the nearest access tunnels and through bullet-scorched hatches, hunting their prey.
"They'd best keep their blades to themselves," Apis growled. "My warriors won't hesitate to send them back to the Blood God if they get rambunctious. They know the scent of their prey, never fear,"
Lacamhew said, looking down his nose at the other word-bearer.
"And if your warriors are stupid enough to raise a weapon against them, they deserve whatever fate awaits them."
"Enough, both of you. Apis, the vault, now."
Apis shook his head.
"My apologies, my lord. This way."
The vault sat at the bottom of a convoluted stairway. Blood stained the steps, and spent shell casings rolled away untidily as they descended. Bodies had been dragged into side passages, or simply kicked down the steps to the chamber at the bottom. The chamber was large and circular, lined with rounded pillars and alcoves. In the latter, plinth-mounted statues stood, staring down at the invaders.
"The servitors were disguised as statues," Apis said.
He motioned to an empty plinth.
"The first we knew of them, they were leaping down right on top of us."
The signs of that battle were everywhere. Torn bodies lay huddled in the corners, or scattered in pieces across the floor. The twisted, blackened remains of the two servitors were in the center of the chamber, in a wide circle of ash. A word-bearer stood over them, a flamer cradled loosely in his hands. Two others stood sentry before a heavily reinforced doorway.
"Any sign of life?"
Apis said.
"Nothing,"
the word-bearer with the flamer said.
"If they're in there, they're keeping quiet. We've already disabled the environmental controls and the oxygen circulators. It's probably quite stifling in there now." "Maybe they suffocated,"
one of the others said with a chuckle. His companion laughed.
"Maybe they killed each other in desperation. Wouldn't that be funny, Apis?" "No, Gurnt,"
Apis said.
"It wouldn't." "Well, I think it'd be funny,"
Gurnt said.
"Quiet,"
Apis said, as Amatnam stepped past him and went to the door. The vault was not of a kind he recognized. He suspected it was akin to a bunker, and that the library had been built around it. He leaned close, running his hands along the visible joins. There was no obvious way in. On the other side, probably. He tilted his head. There was a faint hum just audible on the vox.
"Ghost signal," he said.
He looked at Lacamhew and tapped the side of his helm.
"Hear it, brother? Someone is receiving vox messages in there."
"From where?"
Lacamhew asked.
"Let's find out."
Amatnam stepped back.
"Should we blow it open?"
Apis asked, running a hand along the door.
"I have the remaining melter charges handy. Might bring down the roof, though."
"No, there are easier ways. Look there, at the pillars." Amatnam gestured.
"There are sensor nodes in every pillar. The locking system is automatic. They need someone to open the door from the outside."
"We probably should have taken prisoners,"
Gurnt said.
"No, they wouldn't trust such a task to someone who could be taken captive or killed so easily."
Amatnam kicked at the ash around the remains of the servitors for a moment and grunted.
"There we are, as I thought."
Lacamhew growled impatiently.
"Why are we here? What is in there that's so important?"
"Do you ever think about faith, brother?"
Amatnam said, as he sank to his haunches. He plucked the blackened skull free of the ashes and examined it. Wires hung from it, and strange devices, now warped by heat, clustered the skull like barnacles.
"Constantly,"
Lacamhew said. "Have you ever wondered if we're wrong. Amatlim stood, still clutching the skull. He looked at the Dark Apostle. Lakemhue was staring at him in incomprehension. Finally, he said,
I have not.
No, I don't suppose you have. Amatlim paused. Neither have I come to that.
Oh, then why ask the question?
Someone must.
I was right, you are mad.
Faith unquestioned is a blade untested, Amatlim said. He extended the skull. They do not question. That is why they worship a corpse.
And we worship the Pantheon.
Yes, the four paths to the primordial truth. Amatlim pulled the skull to his chest and flicked ash from its crumbling crown. He held it gingerly, careful not to crush it, and continued to brush away ash until a metal barcode was revealed, set into the skull.
We follow all in moderation, and thus avoid truths becoming lies.
Even as the Urizen taught us.
And yet Erebus encourages some among our brothers to follow one god or the other, when it suits his purposes, as if offering their souls up in sacrifice.
Amatlim glanced slyly at Lakemhue, watching to see if his jibe had struck home.
If they are not strong enough to wield the blade, then the stone is their fate,
Lakemhue replied with pious certainty.
Yes, sometimes I wonder, though, will it ever be our turn to lay on that stone?
Only if we fail.
Amatlim held the skull up to the closest pillar. An unseen sensor blurted a code sequence. Scanning pulses danced across the skull, reading the barcode, as it would have done when the servitor had been functional. There was a hiss of escaping air, and hidden pneumatics groaned to life. Amatlim crushed the skull and cast the pieces aside as the great door began to open.
There we are. Come, brothers! Let us see what there is to see.
Pressurized air jetted from unseen vents as the vault cracked wide. Amatlim waved the others forward and drew his sidearm. Gurnt was the first through, and as he stepped into the vault, a heavy weapon opened up, driving him back against the frame of the portal. He returned fire, his bolt gun roaring.
I count six hostiles, possibly more,
he spat as the others sought cover to either side of the opening. Impact craters opened on his battle plate, and he sank down, cursing.
I could use some help! Patience, brother, Apis said.
He plucked a frag grenade from his belt, but before he could throw it, Amatlim caught his wrist.
No, I don't want anything damaged. Lakemhue, send in your hounds.
Lakemhue gestured, and the bloodletters surged forward, through the doorway and into the vault. Screams and shouts followed. Amatlim stepped through as Apis dragged Gurnt to his feet. The vault was not as massive as he'd assumed. Rather, it was a utilitarian space, crammed with scrivener plinths, where scribe servitors hunched, their mechanical limbs twitching across spools of parchment. More parchment lay in heaps and drifts, every inch covered with lines of script. Tables had been overturned at the rear of the vault, and he spied robed adepts crouched behind them fearfully, aiming weapons that had likely not seen use in decades. Among them were half a dozen battle sisters, the hostiles Gurnt had noted. One of the women hefted a heavy bolter. It was braced across one of the overturned tables, and she let it drift with a gunner's grace. Servitors were blown to bits, even as they continued at their labours. One of Apis's warriors staggered, sparks and pressure fluid spilling from his battle plate. The other battle sisters immediately consolidated their fire on him. The warrior fell like a toppled tree and did not move. The bloodletters reached them then. The woman with the heavy bolter kicked back from the table and swung it about. A demon rolled away, screeching. Steam rose from its red flesh. Something about the rounds had hurt it more than he'd expected. Materialized Neverborn could be banished with enough damage, but Amatlim suspected there was something else at play. Some form of blessed ammunition, perhaps. One of the other women, the leader, he thought, turned her weapon on the closest servitor and blew its shriveled brains out.
Destroy the Ricardas, she roared. Grenades!
Stop them, he said.
Targeting runes settled over a scribe's pale, frightened features, and he fired, reducing the man's head to a red mist. Apis and the others followed suit as the bloodletters rampaged among the defenders. A few grenades made it, and explosive fragments peppered Abatnim's armor, but the majority of the servitors continued their work, uncomprehending and unaware of the battle going on around them. It was over in moments, though it seemed to take much longer. The battle sisters died standing, demon blades cutting them down, even as Bolterfire chewed their frames. The scribes were next, and the bloodletters howled as they collected skulls with savage abandon. Soon, only the woman he'd identified as the leader remained. She took cover behind the servitor plinths, using them to make her way towards one of the alcoves that studded the far wall. Whatever she was going for, Amatnim knew he couldn't allow her to reach it. He paced swiftly after her. Right on her heels, he reached for her. But at the sound of a sharp click, he jerked back. The woman spun, her fist aflame. He avoided the blow, but she continued to move. Her knee caught him in the side, and he stumbled, off balance. The burning fist cracked across the side of his helm, and the heat caused his display to flicker. He drew his axe rake and swept it out, driving her back, knocking the crackling power ball from her hand. She was fast, her power armor lending her speed, but he was faster. He landed a blow that tore a ragged hole in her armor and the meat within. She staggered, somehow still on her feet, backing towards the alcoves. Blood stained her mouth and chin as she bared her teeth. He circled her, getting between the wall and her. She lurched forward, burning fist raised. He caught the blow, felt the heat envelop his hand and forearm. He chopped his blade into her side and pulled, wrenching her augmetic arm from the shoulder housing in a flurry of sparks. She screamed then, a gasping, gurgling cry, and he sent her tumbling away with a twitch of his blade. He studied the burning hand for a moment and then tossed the artificial limb over his shoulder.
You fought well, but the end was never in doubt.
She fumbled at the ground, trying to rise. A quick diagnostic scan showed major internal injuries, broken bones and ongoing blood loss. She would be dead in moments. Demons crept close, splintered fangs bared in eagerness. Red, raw things, their muscles moved like pistons beneath crimson flesh. They scraped their brass blades across the walls and floor as they circled her, tasting her blood on the air. One, unable to contain itself, darted forward. Amatnim caught it by the horn as it lunged past him and gave it a sharp jerk, snapping whatever passed for its neck. The body dissolved like molten metal. The other Neverborn drew back, snarling in frustration.
There was no need for that,
Lacomhue said disapprovingly.
Keep them under control, and I won't have to do it again.
Let them have her. What does it matter?
Keep them back until I say otherwise. I wish to speak to her.
Amatnim dropped to his haunches beside the woman.
They will have you before you die, if I let them. Indeed, they will make the moment of your death stretch for hours, before they lose their hold on the Materium. Do you understand me?
She shook her head, coughing. Blood splattered the stones. He tried again.
You are strong. I can help you. I will help you. Simply ask, and I will keep them from you. I will give you that much, if you but ask.
He could not be certain she understood him. Pain had dulled her mind to animal simplicity. She tried to crawl away, her body barely responding. It was only when he caught sight of the bolt pistol laying half-hidden beneath a fallen servitor that he understood. He reached out, caught the weapon with the hook of his axe rake, and dragged it towards her. She caught it with a groan, and the gathered demons hissed in pleasure. She slumped and rolled, painfully, slowly, until she could aim the weapon at him. Amatnim did not move. He crouched and waited. She pulled the trigger. There was a loud chunk. The bolt pistol was empty. He smiled.
The gods yet have need of me, it seems.
But your part in this has come to an end, I fear. She fell back, breathing in short, ragged gasps. The demons leaned close, eyeing him warily. They hungered for her soul. He removed his helm and set it aside as he hunkered over her.
"Ask, and I will give you peace," he whispered into her ear. "Just ask."
She spat in his face. He sat back and wiped her blood from his cheek. She gave a rattling sigh and went limp. He crouched for a moment longer, giving her soul the time it needed to depart. Then he rose, rubbing her blood between his fingers. He looked at the Neverborn. One of the creatures rose on its hooves, its angular, narrow body stretching as it thrust its skeletal features close to his own. It spoke, in a voice like stones rolling through broken glass. The words slipped from his mind the moment he heard them, but he understood regardless. The others rose as well, converging on him. He smiled. "My apologies, but she was mine. My kill. There are other souls in this place. Have them, if you would." His smile faded. "But this one was mine." He held the demon's gaze for long moments. It gave a contemptuous snort and turned away, dragging its blade along the ground. The others followed it as it loped away, out of the vault, seeking new prey.
"You take chances, my lord,"
Apis said from behind him.
"The gods love a gambler." Amatnim looked down at the dead woman. "She was strong. Mad, but strong. It is a shame that they are blind to the glories of the primordial truth. 100 of them would be the equal of 1,000 cultists."
"They say some have come to know the truth. Only a few, though."
Apis drew a combat knife from his belt.
"I will add her skull to the pyramid."
Amatnim gestured.
"No. Leave it where it is. We have plenty for the pyramids. If Khorne wishes this one in particular, he may collect it himself."
He turned and looked at the alcoves. What was she after? Lachimhu gestured with his crosiers.
"Likely the controls to those flamer jets set into the ceiling. I think she meant to incinerate this vault and everything in it."
He joined Amatnim and looked down at the body.
"You should have let the Neverborn have her."
He glanced around.
This is why you blazed a path through this system. Parchment. The tattered philosophies of a dying regime.
Amatnim picked up a length of parchment.
"Look at it."
"Why would I sully my eyes with such filth?"
"Is that any way to talk about the writings of the Urizen, brother?"
Amatnim allowed himself a small surge of pleasure at the look on Lakimhu's face. The Dark Apostle snatched the parchment from him and scanned it.
"No! No, this isn't... Why is this here?"
He dropped the parchment and picked up another handful, and another, becoming more frantic with each.
"What are they doing with his words?"
"Transcribing them."
There were books scattered about. The work of the mortal adepts, Amatnim thought. He leaned close to a servitor, studying the primitive vox relay attached to its spine and skull. The automata had been converted into living receivers. Information filled their heads, and they scratched it down. He'd seen it before on other worlds, but this time the relays were short-range. Whoever was on the other end was close. So close. He smiled. At last. After all these centuries, Amatnim had found him.
"They are defacing them! They are twisting his words!"
Lachimhu spun, teeth bared. His crozier snapped out, and a servitor's head burst.
"Defiers! Apostates!"
"Servitors," Amatnim corrected. "They lack the capacity to understand the enormity of their crime, brother. Indeed, I doubt these even know that we're here."
He lifted a tangle of parchment.
"To answer your question, yes, this is why we are here.
What would you say if I told you that this is not the first chamber of this sort that I have discovered? Lackamhew stared at him.
How many?
More than you'd expect. Less than you might hope.
They feast on us, on our writings, our wisdom, like carrion birds.
Lackamhew sounded horrified.
How has this happened?
What do you notice about these? He held up the parchment and the Colchisian glyphs that had been scratched across them. Look closely. Look here, at the placement. The shape of the glyphs, the writing is from top to bottom rather than across. Lackamhew frowned.
They were written by a Colchisian.
Yes, and recently. Amatnim's smile faded. For more than 100 years I have followed his trail. This lost brother. From world to world, system to system, always a decade or more behind. But now at last I've caught up with him.
A traitor,
Lackamhew said, his disbelief evident. A prisoner. Lackamhew snarled again, and the energy field of his Crozius flared as he tightened his grip on the haft.
The dead take a bearer of the word captive.
They worship the corpse of a god, brother. There are little such creatures will not dare. Amatnim looked around the chamber. This is the object of my quest, brother. Corferin himself set me this task, to find the lost one and bring him home. He smiled. And Erebus set you to stop me. Lackamhew paused. Amatnim leaned close. Now, you are starting to see. You ask yourself why. What reason could the hand of destiny have to fear the return of this lost brother? And how was he lost in the first place? How did he come to be in the hands of our foes for so many centuries? Lackamhew stepped back.
I don't know what you are implying, brother, but choose your words carefully. Erebus would not do this. He would not have a part in this madness.
Then why set you to dog my heels? To hinder or perhaps even kill me? Amatnim raised his hands in a calming gesture. These are the questions any brother of our legion might ask, Lackamhew. And a Dark Apostle especially. You know the machinations of the Dark Council. The strife between hosts, the bitter rivalries between brothers. Dissension, decadence, and despair. It has been the story of us since Nuceria. When your master slew our brightest soul. And for what?
To ensure victory,
Lackamhew growled. And yet we lost.
Not all victories come on the battlefield, brother.
Lackamhew thumped his chest with a closed fist.
We served the will of the gods as we do now.
Yes, as I do. Amatnim bowed his head. The gods have given me this quest, and I will complete it. The only question is, will you help me, or will you allow your loyalty to Erebus blind you to the truth? He extended his hand, a gesture of brotherhood, even on Colchis. Some things were universal. Lackamhew shook his head.
Die!
He turned, looking at the chamber and its contents.
You are mad! This is mad! All of this!
Amatnim noticed Apis surreptitiously raising his bolt gun. He twitched a hand, and the other word-bearer subsided. He needed Lackamhew, for the moment at least. The Dark Apostle's death would bring questions, and questions would bring challenge. There was no telling how many spies Erebus had inserted into the host. Lackamhew was simply the most obvious, the one meant to attract the most attention. Erebus was cunning. One of the few grudging compliments Corferin had ever paid him, in Amatnim's hearing. Amatnim still wasn't sure why Erebus wanted to prevent him from succeeding in his mission, but he was certain that the self-proclaimed Hand of Destiny would stop at nothing to do so. But if he could turn Lackamhugh, reveal the truth to him.
Victory hangs by a thread, brother. Will you help me?
Lackamhugh looked up. Before he could answer, however, an alert chime sounded over the vox. A Macnum cursed.
What is it?
The reply was garbled and static-ridden.
Fleet inbound! Enemy vessels!
A Macnum turned to Apis.
Get upstairs! Burn everything! I will see to this place.
We're easy targets, scattered on the ground,
Lackamhugh said.
They won't hesitate to pound this world flat, to kill us!
I am aware. That is why I chose to use gunships,
Lackamhugh grunted.
Perhaps I should not have questioned you then.
Was that an apology, brother?
It was as close as you're going to get. What do we do with this place?
A Macnum pulled a grenade from his belt.
Incendiary grenade, my own design. We shall reduce this place to ashes, and all its secrets with it, now that I have seen it.
He motioned to the doors.
Go, brother. Wouldn't want you caught up in the purifying conflagration, would we?
A Macnum,
Lackamhugh began.
Go, brother. We shall talk more later.
He could smell smoke. The burning had started again, now that the fighting was done. Every volume of lies in this place would be consigned to the flames, one at a time, before they departed. It would take time, but anything of importance did. A Macnum turned and tossed the grenade. There was a flash, a surge of heat, and then the cleansing fire. Chapter 10 48-40-00 Pergamon, Secunda's Great Tithe World. Ships burned like stars in the black, soundless and furious. Cruisers hammered at each other. Gun batteries filled the void with punishing light. Thousands died with every passing second. Sabodan Khan laughed. It was a low, throaty sound, the purr of some great cat, as it tasted the blood of its prey for the first time. He reclined in his command throne, hololithic data feeds flickering about him. He paid them only the scantest attention. The vox systems of his throne crackled with the voices of his captains. As he'd predicted, the enemy had decided to give chase to those few vessels that had escaped Pergamon. The hunters had strung their vessels out in a loose formation, the better to isolate their chosen prey. They had not been expecting an attack, and now they suffered for it as their quarry slid away into the dark.
Glorious, he said.
On the bridge view screen, a vessel, not one of his, died a torturous death, spilling its innards across the starscape.
Glorious,
he repeated, louder. He leaned forward.
If we but had a few more ships,
it would still not be enough, Canem said from behind him. You know this, my Khan. We have caught them by surprise, but only for the moment. They will turn on us soon and bite back.
Sabodan tossed the storm seer a sour look, but said nothing. Canem was right. They had caught the foe by surprise, but that was all. The enemy were preoccupied with Pergamon and its orbital dockyards. The majority of their vessels were in formation to attack a planet, not defend against a hostile fleet. But they were already moving into position. New lines of fire were being drawn, and confusion was giving way to eagerness. For some warriors of the Adeptus Astartes, void war was deemed an unpleasant necessity, a thing to be done, and quickly. But for others, it was as the sweetest of mare's milk. Those space marines often came to command their own vessels. They plotted courses and manoeuvres the way their brothers plied a blade. There would be some of those on the other side.
How long?
He murmured.
My Khan?
How long, Shaman? How long do you think those captains have sailed the stars, since Horus let himself be damned? Longer?
Canem was silent for a moment.
Does it matter?
Of course it matters. Look, there, those ships, closing on our starboard. That's an iron bolt formation. Archaic. Only the Iron Hands still use it with any regularity. Ships' drives have changed some in the thousands of years since that formation was used.
He barked an order, and the chapter serfs on the bridge snapped into action.
We are stagnant, but they are worse.
He continued as the Silent Horseman's great engines fired and the battle barge began to come about. He tapped his head.
Frozen up here, not just in the way of things, but in the way of thinking about things. They are still fighting the last war. Always that war. But we have had many new wars to learn many new ways of doing things.
He raised his sheathed tulwar from his lap in silent signal. The battle barge shuddered as its batteries roared. A frigate convulsed like a wounded beast, twisting on a ruptured core. Another ploughed on, soaking up the fire. It was tougher. Its time in hell had given it a thick skin. But even the thickest skin can be pierced. Another twitch of the tulwar, and the Silent Horseman galloped towards the enemy, prow first. Sabodan heard an intake of breath from Canem and chuckled.
Be at peace, Shaman. I have done this before.
Orc vessels come apart like paper compared to these.
Sabodan laughed.
Ha! Yes, they built them strong in those days.
He leaned forward, teeth bared, a predator on the hunt.
But we build them stronger still.
The moment of impact was loud. Klaxons screamed warnings. The bridge quaked. Sparks dripped from blown cogitators, and servitors squealed in their thrones. A flare of light filled the bridge viewscreen. The Silent Horseman shook as it tore through the burning cruiser. The battle barge remained in one piece, its hull scorched and scored. Sabodan sat back, satisfied. Damage estimates filled the vox. The battle barge had suffered some structural damage, but not as much as it might.
A gamble, Canem said. One that could have cost us.
But it didn't, Sabodan said. War is a gamble, Shaman. We wager heavily and play the tiles we're dealt.
He gestured, and the projections about his throne shifted. Hull sensors mapped the battle, identifying allied vessels and a few enemy ones. Some of the ships facing them had haunted the space lanes of the Imperium for generations. Sabodan marked these as priority targets and relayed the data packets to the rest of the fleet. Canem watched him, frowning.
This is not the time for old grudges.
It is the perfect time. Mark me, these will be the ones to pursue us, or to harry the refugees, if we can draw them off.
The bridge shuddered. Another wave of klaxons added their voice to the cacophony. Sabodan cursed. Void warfare carried with it certain inevitable difficulties. Debris clouds were one. The death of a ship often momentarily blinded the senses of its slayer. Metaphorical blood in the eyes. As the glare cleared, he saw their attacker on the viewscreen, still at the edge of their firing range, drawing closer. A pattern of lights danced across the screen, and the Silent Horseman twitched in pain. The enemy ship slid through the carnage like a tiger, shouldering aside wreckage, guns thundering. It was a monstrous thing, grown fat and foul in the warp. Sabodan stared at it, knowing in his hunter's heart that it was the enemy flagship, the heart of their fleet, as the Silent Horseman was the heart of his.
"Someone's looking for a fair fight," Canem said. "It's a battle barge, I think, or it used to be."
The Stormseer grimaced, as if gripped by a sudden illness.
"Wind's teeth, I can feel the wrongness of it from here. It's a thing of madness, that ship. Better that it did not exist."
"I agree."
Sabodan licked his lips, considering. Possibilities played out in his mind, but only one course was truly viable. Only one made strategic and tactical sense. He growled softly and slumped.
"We've got their attention. Time to turn tail.
What if they don't follow?"
Sabodan stroked his beard.
"They will. We will give them reason enough."
He raised his tulwar.
"But for now, shun withdrawal. It is time to vanish into the tall grass.
Almace, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. Calder moved briskly down the corridor, passing through the shafts of light that marked the high windows to either side. A knot of scribes scattered before him, whispering to one another. He heard every word, but did not react. They feared him enough already. As ever, the corridor was full of mortals, moving in all directions. The cathedral palace never slept. The ecclesiarchy was ever hard at work, saving the souls of the lost, or so they claimed. Calder shared Gilliman's view of them. When he had last walked the world, before being put into stasis, the ecclesiarchy was nothing more than a burgeoning cult. He stopped. For the first time since his arrival, he paused to study the statues that huddled in the alcoves beneath the windows. Saints and heroes he didn't recognize, carved in marble, to adorn a corridor that only a few thousand people would see. What would Dawn make of this, he wondered. Would he share Gilliman's opinion, or would he see some value in this, in the ecclesiarchy itself? Calder stepped closer to one of the statues. A man, clad in robes, fierce-looking. Sebastian Thor. Calder turned. Canonus Law stood nearby, watching him. He nodded respectfully.
Canonus, you have business with the Cardinal Governor?
Had. She came to stand beside him. Do you know the story of Thor?
I do.
She nodded. There are some who think Aemon will follow in his footsteps, that he may well become ecclesiarch in time. She looked at him, her scarred features giving nothing away. For a human, lore was hard to read. I have wondered, is that why the risen sun sent you here?
I was sent to defend this world. That is all I need to know.
Law looked back at the statue. I do not believe you. She was silent for a moment. Then, your warriors have been asking questions, disturbing the equilibrium of this place. It would be better if they did not.
Better for who?
She didn't reply. Calder studied her. Law had all but avoided him since his arrival. Tyre had been his main point of contact. Calder decided not to press the point. He could not afford to alienate the Canonus at this juncture. So, instead, he returned his attentions to the statue. They stood in silence for several moments. Her reserve was impressive. I offended you, she said after some time.
No.
Law grunted. I am glad. She stepped back. You should go. I have taken up enough of your time. The Cardinal Governor will be waiting. She turned and continued on her way. He made no move to stop her. Only when she had lost herself in the crowded corridor did he continue on, still thinking on their confrontation. As before, Aemon was awaiting Calder in his chambers. The Cardinal Governor reclined in a chair on the balcony, sipping a mug of recaf and studying a data slate. Ah, good morning, Lieutenant, he said in greeting, as his bodyguards closed the doors behind Calder. I trust you had a pleasant evening. Calder nodded.
Progress was made. Astropathic reports indicate the Sabodan Khan has engaged the enemy near Pergamon.
Aemon set his data slate aside. And?
Too soon to tell.
Aemon sat back. I suppose a miraculous victory was too much to ask for.
The battle has only just begun.
Calder stood at ease, hands clasped behind his back. He spied several attendants standing silently just out of view. The serfs avoided his gaze with studious reserve. They barely even acknowledged him. He wondered if adjustments had been made to them, or whether they were simply well trained.
I suppose so. The Ecumenical Council is demanding another meeting. I will not be able to put them off for long. The plans you submitted for approval are extensive.
He glanced up, and Calder noticed a solitary cyber cherub crouched at the top of one of the chamber's large bookshelves. The creature was branded with a mark he recognized from his files, not one of Aemon's then.
Not for approval, Calder said. Merely to make you aware of what will be done.
He was used to such word games. Aemon was attempting to exert a soft authority, likely for the benefit of whoever might be watching, via the cherub. Aemon sighed, somewhat theatrically, again for the benefit of the spy. Calder found it somewhat disconcerting how much of Aemon's time consisted of such play-acting. The Cardinal Governor walked a daily tightrope between tyranny and weakness.
"I'm told you went to Lowtown. Might I inquire as to the reason?"
Aemon set aside his mug and began to strip. Two of his attendants came to his aid, pulling off his robes and gently folding them. Beneath the robes, he wore a crimson body glove, studded with sensor nodes. Carefully, a third attendant helped him don a set of training armor. It resembled carapace armor, and had the weight but little of the durability.
"To speak to the planetary magistrate."
"Gil? Why?"
Aemon flexed his hands as his attendants slid a pair of braces over his forearms.
"Some matter I should be aware of?"
"We require reinforcements. I intend to get them."
"From Lowtown?"
"Lowtown will be where the heaviest fighting takes place. It seemed appropriate to begin my efforts there."
Calder watched as one of the attendants brought Aemon a blunted dueling saber.
"Have I interrupted something?"
"No. I could do more than one thing at a time. One of my few skills."
He whistled, and something lurched out of a corner, pulling aside a dust cover as it moved. It was a servitor, though of a higher quality than Calder was used to. This one was not one of the mass-produced lobotomized labourers so common to the industrial sectors of the Imperium. Instead, it was a thing of grand artifice, narrow and murderous-looking, with carefully balanced artificial limbs and ornate carvings covering its armoured torso. The only bit of flesh visible was around its eyes, which peered out from behind a mask of wrought brass. It was studded with religious iconography, and its arms ended in short, blunt blades. Power cables and nutrient feeds emerged from its helm like braided hair and spilled down its back to a streamlined power unit.
"Beautiful, isn't she?" Aemon said.
"It was a woman."
"Oh, yes. One of the finest swordswomen ever produced by House Helmoir of Necromunda. She ran afoul of an acquaintance of mine. She kept bad company, and was consigned to be made over into something more useful. They left her skills intact, but took everything else."
Aemon presented his blade with a flourish, and the servitor copied the gesture with its bladed limbs.
"She was a gift from the aforementioned acquaintance. Even a cardinal governor must keep his skills sharp, for all that I will never be allowed on a battlefield."
The servitor lunged. It was swifter than Calder had expected, but so was Aemon. It parried its blow and backed away.
"So, you're drafting criminals, then? Is that wise?"
He spoke without difficulty as he parried a second blow and riposted, driving the servitor back.
"It is necessary."
"I hear that phrase too often for my liking."
Uncertain as to how to reply to such a comment, Calder settled for saying nothing at all. Aemon and the servitor continued their dance. From Calder's perspective, the Cardinal Governor was competent. Any Space Marine aspirant could have defeated him, but it would require some effort on their part. As far as normal humans went, he was exceedingly skilled. Calder himself was more than competent with the blade. He had learned the art of it from its greatest student, Sigismund, or rather those trained by Sigismund. Instinctively, his hand fell to the hilt of his power sword, as Aemon avoided a blow that would have spilled his intestines on the floor, had he been half a second slower, and the blades not been blunted.
"What else? How goes the landing zone preparations?"
"All completed. Elements of the Raven Guard and the remaining White Scars have been dispatched to the other cities to aid in the defence efforts. Most will remain here, in support of my own Imperial fists."
Aemon stopped. The servitor paused as well. He looked at Calder.
"It sounds like you've already written off Joyner's Rest and the other cities."
Calder nodded.
"We lack the forces to defend every weak point. Therefore, we must choose. Almacia is the capital, and the only city with a functioning docking spire. It is unlikely that the enemy will devote more than a third of their resources to taking the rest of the planet. They will converge where the defence is strongest, in order to secure a quick victory. If we can hold Almacia and maintain fleet coherency,
then we might stand a chance."
Aemon chewed his lip for a moment.
"Are the odds truly stacked against us?"
"They are.
Eamon laughed. No false confidence, then.
There is no purpose in obfuscating the obvious. A realistic appraisal of our chances is preferable to a well-intentioned lie. Only through accurate data can I make the proper projections.
I see. I suppose you've used up all that politis I noted earlier.
I assumed it was not necessary between us at this late date.
Eamon gestured, and the servitor retreated to its alcove. He handed his sword to one of his servants and went back to his table. He sat down and poured himself a goblet of wine.
If that is the case, then I might well ask why you've been questioning my people about the schematics for the Cathedral Palace.
He looked at Calder over the rim of his goblet.
I thought we had already cleared all of that up.
Calder did not reply immediately. Law had asked him a similar question. He had expected Eamon to avoid the topic. He wondered if his meeting with Law had been as much happenstance as it had seemed, or whether it had been a probing strike. Was this simply another duel? The thought irritated him.
No. You refused to answer my questions, so I sought the answers I required elsewhere.
And?
They also refused to answer.
Because there are no vaults. There are no hidden places here. And if there were, it would be my duty to defend them against any who might seek to open them.
Eamon spoke carefully, slowly. Calder weighed his tone and emphasis and decided that Eamon was asking him to forget his question.
I was sent here to defend this world, he said with equal deliberation. To do that, I must have access to every part of it, every secret place and hidden route.
And you have been granted that access.
Eamon did not quite meet his gaze. Calder would have been impressed if he had. Few humans could for any length of time.
Or are you accusing me of lying?
Are you?
Eamon refilled his goblet.
Are you a worshipper of the God Emperor, Lieutenant?
No,
Calder said.
I serve him, but I do not worship him.
Do you doubt his divinity, then?
Eamon looked at him, his face suddenly worn and haggard-looking. It wasn't simply his recent exertions, but something else.
I have never been to Terra, but I can feel him, nonetheless.
He touched his chest.
I feel the resonance of his voice here, in my heart. He speaks. You have but to listen.
I have two hearts, Cardinal Governor. Which one is it that he speaks to?
Eamon shook his head, his eyes sad. He slumped in his chair and drained his goblet.
You mock me. I forgive you.
I do not mock you. The Emperor of Mankind is a fixed point. Divine or not, we both serve him. Which is why you will tell me what I need to know.
I have!
Eamon snapped. He paused, realizing what he'd done.
Forgive me. But these vaults you speak of, these hidden paths, I do not know what they are. I cannot tell you what I do not know.
Calder said nothing. Eamon waited, as if expecting a reply. When it didn't come, the Cardinal Governor sighed.
You don't trust me, do you?
Trust is earned.
Eamon winced.
And haven't I earned it yet?
Again, Calder said nothing. Eamon looked away, his gaze coming to rest on the great books that occupied the shelves around the chamber.
Have you ever read the classics, Lieutenant? Govana's Historia Regum Terra, for instance, or Penton's The Riddle and the Throne, histories of the Imperium, written by the most learned scholars of the ages.
I do not read fiction, Calder said simply.
He'd found that most of the texts written in the past 10,000 years were little more than children's stories, a nugget of truth in a shell of complete fabrication. Eamon turned.
You would see them that way, wouldn't you? You lived it. Do you remember the day the Emperor drove the monsters from Terra?
Calder hesitated. He barely remembered those days. He'd been a child when the traitor legions had laid siege to Terra. Sometimes he had flashes of running and hiding from purple armored warriors. One of his brothers screams as they flayed him alive, so that they might have his bones and skin to wear into battle. He recalled the look on his father's face as they dragged him into the open, guttural laughter shaking the air. As always, he pushed those thoughts down. He was not that child anymore. He was Primaris, the ultimate weapon built for the last war. And nothing more would be taken from him, not by traitors or demons or Xenos.
"They were not monsters then," he said. "Not all of them."
Aemon nodded. "Regardless, so much of what the Ecclesiarchy has built came from the ashes of that great conflagration. We pulled together the framework of the Imperial Creed with bloody fingers and crafted a faith from hearsay and hope." He struck his chest with a fist. "We did it. Us. We saw what was needed, and we did it. We united mankind in its darkest hour, and we have held them together since then. Whatever has come. So many times, disaster was averted only by faith and fire." He gestured to the shelves. "You call it fiction. I call it hope. We give hope, Lieutenant." Aemon snatched up his goblet and took a deep swallow. "And you hate us for it," he continued. "Not without reason, I admit. Some among the Holy Synod have yielded to temptation. But for everyone who falls, 100 more stand firm, because we believe. Our belief sustains billions, and yet you cannot bring yourself to trust us. To trust me."
Calder looked around the chamber, at the great shelves of books and the ornate fireplace, at the high windows looking out over the city. He considered his reply from every angle, remembering Sir Bodin's warning as he did so. Aemon was trying to divert him, to anger him, perhaps. It was a distraction, a ploy to avoid revealing whatever it was that he was hiding, what this planet was hiding. More and more, he was becoming convinced that Gilliman had sent him here not just to defend this world, but to ferret out whatever secret it held. Whatever it was might mean the difference between victory and defeat. He turned back to Aemon.
"Irrelevant," he said firmly. "I do not hate you. You are a strange thing to me, for when I last walked the galaxy, you did not exist. And yet, the more I learn of you, of the Ecclesiarchy, the more I find that it is unpleasantly familiar. You are the shadow on the cave wall, a little thing magnified by false perceptions."
"Lieutenant," Aemon began. Calder continued, not giving him a chance to speak.
"This debate serves no purpose, save as a distraction. I do not care what you have done, or why you have done it. I do not care why you seek to hide it from me. I care only that you hinder me in the performance of my duty. Thus far, I have allowed it. But the time is coming when I will not take no for an answer, Cardinal Governor."
Aemon went still. "Is that a threat?"
"It is a promise."
Calder left without waiting to be dismissed. As the doors to Aemon's chamber closed behind him, he activated an encrypted vox link.
"Karos, brother, meet me in the Strategium."
Karos responded almost immediately.
"Is everything all right, brother? You sound almost angry. Very unusual for you."
"I am fine, but we have matters to discuss."
Calder cut the link. He realized that he'd stopped again, before the statue of Sebastian Thor. He stared at it for a moment, before the whir of tiny wings alerted him to an observer. He turned slightly. Almost a dozen cyber-cherubs watched him. The tiny automata were perched on the other statues, or in the corners. Their eyes whirred and clicked, capturing his image for unseen observers. Calder held those blank gazes for a moment. Then, deliberately, he turned and continued on his way. Karos sat back on his haunches.
"Interesting," he murmured.
He crouched on the ledge of a cathedral spire, overlooking a wide avenue, colloquially known as Fell's Triumph.
The eastern reaches of Hightown spread out below him in splashes of grey and gold. Clouds of industrial smog and incense drifted over the buildings, obscuring much of the street below. A sudden rush of birds agitated the clouds as they spilled upwards into the sky above.
Brother?
Solaro, a reaver, crouched behind him. Karos glanced at the Primaris. Like the Imperial Fists, his command was split roughly 50-50 between new and old. The chapter believed in integration where possible. Then, they had always been adaptable. Solaro was the only one of his kind here. The other five Raven Guard, perched at various points on the roof, were, like Karos, of a more traditional bent. Solaro normally commanded his own squad, but Karos wanted to observe him in the field.
Calder is losing his patience for the Cardinal Governor's games, he said, answering Solaro's question.
He stretched discreetly, flexing each muscle in its turn, easing the flow of fatigue poisons. It would be some time before he had to rest, or even cramped up. He'd once perched on a similar rooftop for close to a week, awaiting the perfect moment to end the life of an orc war leader. He closed his eyes, remembering the oily taste of the rain that day, and the rough, bellowing speech of the greenskin as it addressed its followers in crude mimicry of an imperial commander rousing the troops. He'd taken the creature's head off with his first shot. Its followers had succumbed to raucous infighting some minutes later. Orcs were nothing if not efficient when it came to establishing a new chain of command. Luckily, it made them easy prey.
"Why has he indulged the mortal for so long?" the reaver asked. "At the first sign of deceit, we should have removed him from power." "Ah, Solaro, I forget sometimes that not all of you Primaris are as old as Calder. You are barely 3 decades into your duty. Long enough to know better than to indulge such foolishness." "Not foolishness," Karos said. "Wisdom. Deposing Aemon would result in increased civil unrest, and other than his unwillingness to discuss certain matters, Aemon is more useful where he is. He provides a necessary buffer between us and the ecclesiarchal bureaucrats who rule this world." "He's a wall, you mean?"
Solaro said. Karos glanced.
"Was that humor, brother?" "How unexpected." "A slip of the tongue,"
Solaro replied.
"It wasn't a reprimand, Solaro. Even the Sons of Dorne make jokes on occasion. Ah, there we are, right on schedule."
Karos turned as one of the sensors he'd placed on the street below registered movement. The avenue was lined with bulk warehouses, linked directly to an array of transit lifts. The lifts were ancient technology, gravimetric suspension systems that could carry a void-hardened cargo platform to the orbital docking spires above the city. Once the platform had its load, it would descend at speed until reaching the base of the lift. In peacetime, the lifts made the journey hundreds of times a day. They had been rendered inoperable until the current crisis was passed by teams of civilian engineers. Or such was supposed to be the case. Someone had ignored the edict. According to the warriors he'd sent to watch, the lift in Warehouse 32 Omega had been active 15 times in the past 3 days. That was more than merely suspicious, given the circumstances. It was potentially treasonous. Karos decided to investigate, while there was still time to indulge in such amusements personally. Calder lived for his way of war, of numbers and strategies, but Karos enjoyed taking a more active role. He'd never lost his taste for shadow war. Down below, a civilian transport had come to a stop on a side street behind the warehouse. It was a heavy vehicle, rugged, built for mountain travel. Whatever they were bringing down from orbit, they were planning to take it out of the city. 5 men climbed from the vehicle. There were 30 more in the warehouse. Karos blink-activated an augur rune on his display. The rune controlled the feed from the pick recorders Solaro and the others had surreptitiously mounted around the outside of the warehouse. The feed, filtered through his helmet pictor, filled a corner of his display. Activating a second rune, he isolated the faces of the men who disembarked and ran them against the list of persons of interest Calder had put together.
"Interesting," he said. "Heretics," Solaro said. "Maybe They're also criminals, at least according to Calder's files.
Karos raised a hand, signalling the other Raven Guard.
They're armed, but nothing that should trouble us. I want prisoners, if possible. Jane, Daron, I want that orbital lift out of commission, permanently. The rest of you, especially you, Solaro, follow my lead. We'll conduct a standard smash and sweep. Don't bother giving chase if they run. Concentrate on the ones who stand and fight, or try to hide.
Solaro nodded.
When you say prisoners, I mean in one piece.
Karos stood.
Go.
Without waiting to see if the others were following, he leapt from his perch and slid down the slope of the spire. Ancient tiles splintered and cracked beneath him, but he paid them little heed. Instead, he concentrated on the sudden drop ahead and the necessary calculations for what came next. When he hit the edge, he leapt, angling his body just so. The others did the same, one after the other. Between their enhanced frames and the strength-augmenting fiber bundles of their power armor, there were few leaps that a space marine could not take on faith. Ordinarily, he would have employed stealth. It would have been easy for him and his men to infiltrate the warehouse and subdue those inside. But sometimes it was preferable to make a statement. Whoever was inside thought they could flaunt their crime under the noses of the Emperor's Chosen. Such hubris could not be allowed to go unchallenged. Thus, the leap. The roof of the warehouse was made from recycled sheet metal, a local variety, thin but durable. Not durable enough to survive the impact of a fully armored space marine, traveling at high speed, however. Karos barely felt the moment of impact. The sheet metal buckled around him, and the support frame bent away from its contact points. It barely slowed his descent, and he plummeted towards the ferrocrete floor below, in a cloud of torn metal and busted frame. He landed with a crash, the gyroscopic stabilizers built into his armor keeping him upright. The floor cracked around him, and dust geysered. 2.3 milliseconds after impact, he was already moving. His armor's auto-sensors built a map of his surroundings as he ran towards the closest identified target. The warehouse was a massive square of space, broken up only by walkways and storage berths. The transit lift rose from its center. It was a derrick-like structure mounted on a flat plinth, stretching upwards through the roof and high into the air. There were men scattered about the lift, and mountains of crates. Most of the men were busy unloading the transit lift, but the rest turned. Slowly, so slowly, as Karos raced towards them. He drew his bolt pistol and fired, letting the targeting runes guide his aim. 3 shots and 3 men fell, not dead, but perhaps wishing they were. Around him, Solaro and the others fired their own weapons. Precise bursts hammered the air. Men dived for cover as crates of contraband were chewed to flinders. Karos slid to a halt, firing again, driving men back from the transit lift. A mortal, desperate or perhaps simply optimistic, came at him with a blade. The sword was the sort hive gangers might carry, a chopping blade with none of the grace or balance of a proper weapon. Karos caught the blow on his forearm and swiped the blade from its owner's hands. Before the man could run, Karos caught him by the throat and sent him flying into a knot of his fellows. He pivoted, firing, forcing the rest of them to keep their heads down as he turned his attention elsewhere. His picta unit was linked to those worn by Solaro and the others. He saw what they saw. His warriors had spread out through the warehouse and were following his example. They fought to disable rather than kill, but it didn't make much difference. Mortals fell, bones broken, bodies pumping blood from wounds that would eventually prove fatal without medical attention. Karos paid them little attention. If they lived, they would be questioned. If they died, they died. What mattered was that his warriors were following orders. Autoguns roared, and crude explosive rounds bit into his armor, momentarily rocking him. He turned, backtracking the trajectories. His bolt pistol boomed in response, and runes flashed, signaling that the targets were down. His auto-sensors focused on a group of men, heading for the transit lift, trying to escape, perhaps. He stalked after them, signalling Solaro with a vox click as he did so. Through his picta, he spotted the Reaver racing across the top of a nearby stack of crates, combat knife in hand. There was no need to give an order. The Primaris knew what to do. Solaro vaulted from the crates and crashed down, knife flashing. Men fell, their hamstrings sliced clean through. Their screams scattered the rest. Only one continued towards the transit lift, a heavyset man, clad in a silk jacket and battered military fatigues. A name flashed on his display, as his armor's sensors identified the man. Cormas Belloc, one of the gang leaders Calder had wanted to see. Karros cycled through the frequency band. When he found the one used by the enforcers, he sent a coded data pulse containing a pict of Belloc and their current location. He estimated that the enforcers would arrive by the time he and his warriors had done what they'd come to do. Belloc carried a heavy autogun with a bulky ammunition drum, and he laid down a withering field of suppressive fire. Solaro was knocked sprawling. His battle plate was lighter than Karros's own, and while it protected him from harm, it wasn't as good at absorbing impacts. He rolled away from the gunfire, seeking cover. Karros pressed forward, drawing the gunman's attention.
"Good shot," Solaro voxed. "He's had training," Karros said.
That wasn't in the files, but it didn't surprise him. He moved quickly, but without haste. He was curious as to Belloc's plan. Where was there to go? Belloc backed away, retreating towards the transit lift. Karros laughed. The man had courage, at least. Not everyone would risk an orbital ascent. Then, not everyone had space marines chasing them.
"Chain, status," he said. "Mission accomplished."
There was a dull boom as a plasma charge went off. Metal groaned, and smoke rose up and boiled outwards, flooding the area around the transit lift. Belloc spun, eyes wide. He cursed and turned back as Karros approached. The autogun roared, spitting high-velocity rounds. Karros walked through the fusillade, his battleplate registering and recording the impacts. The rounds weren't heavy enough to punch through his armor, but they were far in advance of the usual gang of trash.
"A good weapon,"
he said. He boosted his vox so that his voice boomed out like thunder.
"How did you come by it?" "I'll pay for it,"
the mortal spat. He emptied the ammunition drum and made to eject it. Karros sprinted forward and slapped the empty weapon from the man's hands.
"I'm sure,"
Karros said. He caught the man by the throat, hoisted him up, and propelled him backwards against a crate.
"You are a smuggler."
"I'm a businessman,"
the mortal choked out as he clawed uselessly at Karros's forearm. Karros observed him for a moment, slightly impressed by the man's defiance. Unaugmented humans were normally terrified of space marines. Then, perhaps this man had seen worse in his time. Perhaps it was simply hubris. Karros slammed him back against the crate, knocking the wind out of him.
"You were using the transit lift to smuggle in weapons. Why?"
Belloc glared.
"To Sill! Why else?"
"To who?"
Belloc looked at him as if he were insane.
"Everyone! We've heard the rumors. The system is under attack. Weapons make people feel safe. Every two-bit Aristo and Deacon is looking to gun out their bodyguards."
He stopped his struggles.
"Why haven't you killed me yet?"
"Who said I wanted to kill you?" "Enforcers are moving in from either end of the street,"
Solaro murmured across the vox.
"I know. I alerted them."
Karros leaned close to his sweating prisoner.
"Your name is Belloc. You make your money selling black market off-world narcotics and stolen merchandise, bought wholesale from pirates and smugglers."
The man's eyes widened. Before he could speak, Karros continued.
"Unless I miss my guess, you have an appointment with my brother. I expect you shall keep it directly once the enforcers have you in custody. For your sake, I wouldn't resist."
Karros signaled the others.
"Time to go."
He let Belloc fall and tapped him on his bald head, hard enough to make the man wince.
"Remember what I said. If I have to find you, you won't enjoy the experience."
Chapter 11. 570000. Odoasis System. Corward Edge. Ashu leaned forward on his command throne. A grisly smile stretched across his pallid features. The world-bearer flashed obsidian teeth and growled in pleasure.
Look at them, slave. Ripe and fit for plucking.
Slave nodded. Yes, oh, munificent one. He looked at her. She was tall and willowy, like all those born in the void. Her skin was as colourless as Ashu's own, and she wore silken raiment, plundered from an Aldari trading vessel. Her face was hidden beneath a silver mask, wrought in the shape of a demon's leer, and silver chains girt her wrists, waist and neck. The chains were connected to Ashu's throne.
Once you might have been among them, eh?
He pointed to the viewscreen and the straggling column of refugee vessels that stretched across it.
Fearful and blind to the predators on your trail.
Never, my lord. I was fated to serve you, as the gods will.
It is good you know that, slave.
He glanced at the ritual brands that coiled about her arm. He put them there himself, and more besides. He marked all of his slaves, so that they might never hide their allegiances. He had something of a collection, enough to act as crew for his vessel, Callion's Yearning. Even more than his slaves, the Slaughter-class cruiser was his pride and joy. He had strangled its former captain, as she sat in the throne Ashu now occupied. It had carried him through 2 centuries of war since then, and had never failed him. Alongside Callion's Yearning were a handful of smaller escort vessels, raiders and pirates mostly. At least one was the province of an extended clan of devoted followers of the primordial truth. 10 generations of demon worshippers had crewed the creaking scow, and the vox echoed with their chants and hymns. Ashu turned his attentions back to the refugees. At least 12 vessels, most of them small, pleasure yachts, short-haul trading vessels, and 1 antique troop transport making their way slowly out of one of the innumerable debris fields that littered the system.